Mary had a little lamb. The fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went. No.
You're stressing me out in that.
Am I? Yeah. I took it off.
So we're here. We're here on another episode of our podcast. How exciting is this?
That's great. Yeah? It's great. We're looking forward to it.
You really sound excited. I have to admit.
I'm genuinely excited.
That's great.
No, I am. I've been looking forward. I've been receiving all the text messages that I've got from people, and some people I've not spoken to in years and years who have fired across to me, and I'm thinking,
Abuse.
What are you doing? No, it's been really good. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, you've taken your jacket off and relaxed a little bit. Obviously, you've got an important day.
Oh, every day is important for me, though, as you know that. Every day is important.
It's nice to see you relaxed. Anyway, mate, so exciting stuff. Obviously, the World Cup started. We've got Andrew Steele coming in, who we're going to be talking to in a little bit. But before we speak to Andrew, who's a former Olympian, and hear his story and the transition and the journey that he's been on, I thought we should probably have a little chat about the World Cup. England have played their first game against Tonga. Some people have been sort of... debating whether they played as well as they could have done. You know, ultimately it was a 35-3 win for England. But how did you feel about it watching?
I think, you know, like any tour, it's knockout rugby. I know you're in the group stages, but if you're going to go into this match and be told at the beginning of the night, before kickoff, you're going to win the game, you're not going to have any injuries, you're going to score 4 tries, you'd take it, regardless of who you're playing.
Not concede any as well.
Exactly,
so defensively, they...
So there are always going to be people that are going to look at it and say, well, they could have been better, they could have done this, or any team. If you look at any match, and I know we'll talk about other matches as well, I'm sure, but it's about the result at the end of the day. We come to the end of the tournament, and if England are successful and they get to the final and go one step further and actually win in the final, no one will remember the England-Tonga game. So it's about gaining that momentum, staying injury-free, and, you know, scoring the points and getting the build of confidence.
And for England, unlike the other teams, so our boys have got, so we had Tonga, then USA, and then we've got the two harder games at the end. You look at the other pools, New Zealand had South Africa first game.
What a game.
In our pool as well, Argentina and France played each other, you know, so whereas England have got a nice, slow, steady build-up, haven't they? Those boys are straight into it, and, you know, without the... So do you think that...
Well, is that an advantage, you think?
Well... I think an advantage for us. I think the fact that we've got those slow build-ups and then, you know, we're preparing, we can get through those motions. Eddie can get another look at the players that he wants to choose. You know, the starting 15, he might not be quite happy with some of the combinations, so he can change it for the USA game to hopefully then go into Argentina and France and have it nailed down. So I think we have an advantage.
I'm a bit stuck because if I think back to, I've obviously not played in the World Cup in the group games or any games actually.
You went to a World Cup in 1999, right?
But back in those days, you didn't get. I was in a squad, but I didn't get picked to play a game.
So you went to a World Cup for the whole duration of the time England were in it. You didn't actually step foot on the pitch.
Do you know what? I on a match day on a Saturday, my role with the 8 other people that were not selected in the match day 22 was to play football against the coaches and managers.
But that is an important role. I mean, you need to keep, you know, the backroom staff.
I think they stopped
toes,
it after
right?
week 2 because we kept chopping them down. I think it was me, Gareth Archer, Victor Abugi were chopping their legs down because you weren't being picked. But
good
days.
I'd love to talk about, you know, your 99 World Cup experience. But let's talk.
My point is when you play,
I didn't realise you had a point.
I do have a point.
Go on.
If you stopped interrupting me, I'd get to it.
It's nice though that you've got to a point.
My point is, when you play a big game at the start, let's use the start of the season, which I can refer to.
Yeah.
So you don't, sometimes want to play the biggest team first because they're not on the money. They're not ready. They're just as raw.
So you're backing yourself there because you feel your team's prepared.
Yeah, so you're in control. Yeah, rather, there are two ways of looking at it. One, you can build momentum, which is obviously important. But also, if you're going to play New Zealand, for example, would you want to play them after they've got 3 or 4 wins in their belt? Or would you want to play them when they're just coming into the tournament, just landed, just settling in, just getting used to the diet, the food, the sleep, everything else, and play them then? So I suppose there's two ways of looking at it. That's why I look at it and think, you know, 4 tries, a win, no injuries, is huge.
Because, I mean, obviously England had many opportunities in that first half. You know, it was spilt passes, knock-ons, etc. You know, there were so many chances created, which is a real positive. You know, the doubters and the naysayers will say, well, they didn't win by enough and all that sort of stuff. Were they clinical enough? Will they beat New Zealand? If it was New Zealand in that game, do you think England could have stepped up and won it?
Rugby is such a simple game, and you only need to score one more point than the opposition. So what is enough? You know, if they'd have scored another 2 tries, people would have still said they didn't win by enough, in my view.
Yeah.
You look at the Australia-Fiji game.
Yeah.
And there are people...
Great game.
Yeah, really good game. And people were looking at that and after 40 minutes at the scoreboard, then after 60 minutes, then you just see the sides just separate. Yeah. So I think it's about when the final whistle goes, who scored more points than the opposite team? And it's literally as simple as that, in my view.
Is it as simple as that? So the team with the most points win at the end of the game. Is that what you're saying? That's really simple.
Probably why I don't coach. It's probably why I don't go into coaching, but I do break it down. I'm a very simple person and I see things in a simple way. Stop the team from scoring, score one more point from them.
And that's, you know, ultimately England stopped Tonga from scoring, which is a real positive for them, and they got the bonus point. But so coming back to you for a moment, you know, we've done 99 World Cup. You love a bit of you time. You're going out to the World Cup soon. So you're going out as unbelievably a sighting commissioner. So the dirtiest, one just, of the dirtiest backs
let
ever
let
to have played the game.
Let me correct you. I'm not a sighting commissioner. I'm a judiciary officer.
Oh, right. Okay. I couldn't say that. So I went with sighting commissioner. But so you are generally going out there to look
I'm excited.
To look at those, I don't know which ones you're in charge of, but you say it's working. I'd say it's probably more of a holiday. But you've got like three days where you're going to be actually doing stuff for 80 minutes and looking at footage of the games. There's been a lot of chat already around the tackle height and the tackles. How do you feel as a judiciary?
J.O.
As a J.O. How do you feel as a judiciary officer? There you go, I got it, just about. Going out there with all that debate in the background already.
I think it's, you know, there's some issues that have happened in the week, but it's rugby, you know, there are always going to be issues, there's always going to be tackles, it's quite subjective.
And you can't, I should be clear, you can't talk about specific moments because we don't know the outcomes of them at the moment, so.
But for me, there's a key point of what we saw that opening weekend was the hit on Anthony Watson, which was textbook.
Yeah.
Textbook hit, it was hard, it was on the line, but how the referee dealt with that, I thought was brilliant. He stopped. He looked at went to the video, spoke to his assistants, then came up with a conclusion that it was a fair tackle, and Anthony Watson was dropping down. I think that if that decision had gone a different way, then it would have an impact on the whole tournament.
So would it have an impact on how you officiate as well after those games?
Well, no, because the law's a law. You know, the law doesn't change. So but there are World Rugby directives on what constitutes a high tackle. What constitutes a red card and those things, but ultimately the referee's the boss, he's in charge on the day, and then we're only there. Hopefully there's going to be a clean tournament anyway. I think there's always going to be those odd occasions where things fall one side of the line, but you know, it's a physical sport, there are always going to be those things. You try and push it, it's a game of small margins.
We love it, isn't it? Yeah. We love it because it's physical, we want it to be safe, which is why, you know, the powers that be are bringing in the rules and regulations that they are. But yeah, they have mitigating circumstances now, don't they, which I believe is why Watson's one was okay, because he'd almost fallen, so he was actually falling into the hit.
He was lowering down.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, what else could the tackler have done differently? His technique was solid, he was strong, he was low.
Well, he could have done what you did and not actually tackle him.
Yeah.
And then he definitely would have been in any trouble.
Yeah, true. It's very difficult to tackle when you're sat in the changing room wearing a tracksuit. 100% record at it.
Yeah. Mate, so just really quickly to look at some of the other teams.
Are you giving me abuse about tackling, by the way?
That's a tackling machine.
That has just dawned on me.
That's a tackling machine.
The international hooker.
And now everyone knows that you didn't do any tackling. So that's all I remember. I was going to say Minnow Nations. That's completely unfair now, I feel, because I think the rise of all those smaller rugby-playing nations has been massive, and some of the performances they've had in the game so far. You talk about Fiji in the game against Australia, you know, Georgia, okay, they didn't start particularly well, but they had a really strong second half. Namibia and Italy was a good match. How do you feel about those smaller nations and the growth of the game at the moment around the world?
I think it's great. I think the players are playing more, they're stepping outside of their home nation, I suppose, if you like, and playing internationally and gaining experience. I think the gap has decreased. And we saw that with Australia, Fiji. What a result that would have been if Fiji had the power to continue that for 80 minutes.
Yeah. Well, and they hadn't lost a player.
They hadn't lost their best player on the field. But I think we're still going to see, like the last World Cup, we're still going to see some upsets.
Yeah.
But will there be upsets? You know, people, you can't. There are no easy games. You know, if Tonga would have come out and done a job on England, it's not an easy game. You're expecting them to win, but each team is capable of turning somebody over. The difference with the World Cup would be, can they do it once? Can they do it twice? Can they do it three times? Probably not, but they've definitely got it in them to do it once. You just don't want to be on the receiving end of their World Cup moment.
And so, again, just to reflect on, you're going to be in Japan. In terms of the podcast going forward, you're going to be out there. You're going to be our man on the ground, getting some snippets from the big names and names from around the world and getting their thoughts on the World Cup and their memories of the World Cup experiences that they've played in as well. So, you're excited about that?
I'm excited. I've never been to Japan. It was on my tick list of things to do, and when better to do it than when the World Cup's happening as well. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, going out there and just and embracing the culture, the noodles, which I'm a big fan of, as you know, and just getting stuck into it. Yeah, so I've gone out there for the latter stages.
And have you got an idea of the people you want to catch up with? I know you said you spoke to Martin Johnson.
Yeah, I know Jono's out there, Martin Johnson's out there, Benny Kay's out there, Simon Shaw's out there, I think Andy Gomersall.
Just second rows predominantly.
Yeah, just the tall guys. Mike Tyndall, catch up with Tins, I think, as well. Yeah, there's a number of people out there which I hope to catch up with.
So you'll be in Japan. You know,
working
hard, obviously, day in, day out. How long are you there for?
3.5 weeks.
Beautiful. What a holiday.
Working.
I'll be sat here. And the podcast will continue and we'll have a number of different guests coming in. We've got Tim Rodbert as well coming in. That.
I'm gutted to be missing that, actually.
I mean, what a transition he's had from Northampton, England, Lions, to CEO and prolific.
Of multiple businesses as well, yeah. Successful businesses that is exited and sold. So, yeah, if you remember, we heard from Steve Thompson talking about how high of a regard he holds him in, and he wouldn't have achieved what he did if it wasn't for Tim Rodbert. So I don't know if Tim knows that, so it'd be good for you to just put that to him and see how he responds.
Thanks. Remind me just before and I will. I'll do that. So before we introduce you to Andrew Steele, we just wanted to mention that we'd love to hear your thoughts on the World Cup. We'll obviously be having different guests in during the course of the tournament. But if you can hashtag After the Whistle, give us your thoughts, follow us on Twitter. You can follow me at LewisMoody7, or you can follow Leon. What's yours?
LeonLloyd13.
Have you got Instagram as well? Why are we so sad? We like Instagram. We're still reflecting on our past
our
careers.
Numbers in our time.
Moody 7. I mean, yeah. You never even played 13. You were 22 normally.
That was gone. Leon Lloyd, 22, had gone. So I had to go for 13. Yeah.
But come follow us. Give us your thoughts.
Judas.
Sorry, mate. I knew, if I didn't say it, you would have said it to me.
I was going to say it because you played blindside. You never played 7.
Yes.
You
were my brain is working quicker now.
Damn you.
Now that I'm retired. But come and give us your thoughts. Let us know your talking points on the games. And also let us know anyone in particular you'd like us to interview in the next podcast. We've been prattling on long enough now, and we've been talking about this interview with Andrew Steele, so we should probably crack on with it. This is the next episode of After the Whistle. Always exciting to be here. Previous episodes we've spoken about with Steve Thompson. We've looked at resilience. We've spoken to Wayne Hoyle, who had 30 years with the SBS on leadership and transition. And I'm delighted to say with Andrew today, we're going to be looking at health, mental health, among many other areas. But to introduce you formally, you were a Great Britain Olympic 4 meter, that'd be incredibly underwhelming. 4 meter runner.
I absolutely wish.
It's a lot easier.
400 meter and 4x400 meter relay athlete. You spent 12 years competing professionally in track and field. You went to the European Champs, Commonwealth Games, World Champs, and the Beijing Olympics in 2008. You officially, you told me, retired in 2016, but might have switched off slightly earlier.
Yes,
In 2017, you were awarded, in retirement, you were awarded an Olympic bronze medal, retrospectively. You finished fourth initially, and then after some drugs irregularities with Russian athletes, you were awarded your bronze medal. We'll have to talk about that. You are one of the founding team now in retirement at DNA Fit, a global health and wellness company. They have won 2 Queen's Awards in innovation and international trade. They were recently acquired by Prenetics. And unsurprisingly, after the bronze medal incident, you are a passionate advocate of anti-doping. And a couple of obscure facts that we picked up. So you were recently named the 82nd coolest person in food and drink by the Business Insider. Yep. I mean, that is quality.
That's what I always wanted.
The dream. You've got number one single in Botswana. So for a Botswanan rap artist called Foster Giuliano, and it was titled This Is All I Know.
On the album, This Is All I Know, yes. Okay. Yeah, the single itself was called How It's Going Down, of course.
Yeah. I actually listened to that.
Oh, you
I got it
okay.
stuck in my head. Good work. But I couldn't get it out.
How did it go down?
We went down very well for 18 weeks, yeah. Broke the record for the longest standing number one in Botswana chart history at the time. So I'm told. In 2003, this is a good while ago.
Yeah. I mean, 2003 was obviously a good year.
It was a great year for Botswana
as well. And for Botswana.
Yeah, you know, that's it. It's all both equal standards. Standing absolutely the same, you know.
So you would have been training though, right? So you were an athlete at that point.
Yeah, I was just about. Yeah, so I mean, I was almost a DJ and a music producer first, and I was a good athlete anyway. But then like as the athletics got more serious, the lifestyle of a music producer and DJ didn't really fit with the lifestyle of an Olympic athlete. So that started to sort of wane, but. Yeah, it was a good aside, and it's a
fantastic hobby though. That is, you know, your number one record producer in Botswana. You don't even have to say where it is, quite frankly. Do you? They can just
I got a number
that.
One single, guys. That's all that matters. Yeah, yeah.
And we found a couple of other obscure facts which I loved. Your dad is Dr. Chris Steele, who's obviously the resident doctor on This Morning, or has been for the last 30 years.
Yes.
I mean, that is a big boost to fill.
Yeah, I guess so. 30 years on TV is pretty good, I guess. Yeah, yeah.
And most importantly, you're expecting a baby.
Yes.
Imminently.
Like, literally. I mean, so if this is a very short episode, then please excuse me. but hopefully we'll last the whole episode at least. But yes, my first child due any day now, so very exciting and a little bit of trepidation, but mostly excitement.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations.
You know, as parents ourselves, we've both got two. You've got two girls, I've got two boys. We can say it's an absolute joy. I can say that anyway. Although the boys tend to scrap every single moment, waking moment of their life. And the first 4 years, I didn't sleep. But apart from that, it was absolutely joyous. So
great, sounds great.
Good luck. Good mate. So let's look. We can talk about babies whenever. Let's talk about you. And I really want to know. You know, so you spent 12 years competing professionally. With a dream of getting that Olympic medal, and it never arrived. Well, it did arrive, but you were retired.
Yeah.
So I suppose a starting point would be, you know, how did it feel when you retired after that dream, you know, of being a track and field athlete, all your goals going towards those medals, and it doesn't come.
So I think, like, very often in sport, we only really hear the stories of people that reached the ultimate success, I guess, right? And, you know, like yourself, like gold medalists in Olympic Games, etc. Is you tend to, the people that have the platform to tell those stories of what it was like to work towards something and achieve that, then have that, you know, great denouement at the end to say, like, hey, and I won, so it was all worth it.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is everybody else's story is almost exactly the same, apart from that very last sort of part. And I was kept sort of, you know, striving for that. Oh, there'll just be that one race where, hey, it goes, like, really well. And the truth is, like, it was, you know, most sporting careers are sort of a series of failures punctuated by occasional success rather than the other way around, which is kind of what you would see if you were just the layperson watching them. You think, mostly successes and occasionally there's a loss, but actually it's the other way around most of the time. So I think by the time I retired, and the retirement, like you sort of alluded to, kind of happened after I failed to make the London 2012 team, even though I kept going and I had a couple of okay seasons after that, but really my brain had left the building.
Was that one of the big dreams?
Yeah,
you know, alongside a medal, 100%. Was home Olympics.
Because you can just think, like, obviously, Olympic Games, once you're in an Olympic sport, is of course the pinnacle. Then when you've got a home Olympic Games in your lifetime, not only in your lifetime, but at a time when you're physically going to hit your sort of physical peak. I would have been 27 at London 2012, and that's about right for 400 meter runners. And so it all just seemed perfect, and I made the games before, made the semi-final in the individual event, ran a 44 point something time, which is like a benchmark of being world class once you can run under 45. And I was like, right, here we go. This is, everything's gearing up to this. And a few changes happened over those 4 years, and that's what led me to actually discover genetics and the role that I do nowadays at DNA Fit, actually. But
what were the changes that happened during that
so
time? And is that 2008 to 2012?
Yeah, that Olympiad, as they call it. So 2008 to 2012.
So I like to keep across as much sport, science, the arts, world news, etc., as I possibly can do, and that will definitely surprise a lot of my former playing colleagues. But the best place I find to do that is The Economist.
The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. A lot of people would think that that would purely be for business, economics, but the amount of information that just cuts through the noise and gets straight to the real story, you know, it's good, honest journalism. That's what I want to read, and that's what it delivers. And as we know, well, as many may not know, I certainly didn't, The Economist has been a trusted source of intelligence for more than 170 years, covering the various different aspects that we've just mentioned already. So if you've got a curious mind like me, go to The Economist. You can get your hands on a free copy of The Economist by texting AFTER to 78070. That's text AFTER to 78070 for your free print copy. Let's get back to the interview.
Have you guys ever ran a 400 metres?
So at school, I loved, I loved all sport and I really enjoyed athletics, and I ended up, when one of the 400 metre runners dropped out, so I did sort of 100, 200, okay, it was high jump, javelin, they were like, right, rope him in. And I took off for the 400 metres like I was sprinting the 200 metres. And I got to 300 about, you know, 50 metres ahead of everyone else. And then all of a sudden just heard footsteps and I was digging in and I ended up like third or fourth. Right, yeah. It was horrific. Yeah, I remember crossing the line.
I think the 400 metres is the hardest discipline, I think. Fast twitch, shorter distance person.
Yeah.
When we used to train, use 400 meters as our endurance part of training. Mm. And if you're trying to go all out with 400 meters, it's tough. And I only got under 44 seconds once.
yeah.
But I was in great shape.
It's hard to keep it on.
I was not consistent with it. You know, that's the difference between me and the Olympians. But yeah, for me, 400 meters is the toughest sport because you've got to put everything. You've got to empty the tank.
Yeah.
You can't.
And then
you've
still got 100 meters to go.
Yeah.
So that the way I always sort of describe it is, obviously you need to be like an elite sprinter, those really short power athletes. You also need to be a pretty elite middle distance athlete and make those two sort of worlds meet at the same time. And you use up every, you know, fuel source. So if you guys remember from your sort of being exposed to sports science over the years, from your very fast firing fuel source of ATP through to creatine phosphate, lactate phosphate, your body's got all these different energy systems and they fire at different rates. And you basically exhaust all of them because you run more or less flat out from the start. And then everyone, no matter who they are, whether they're world record holders or amateurs, somewhere between sort of 33 and 36 seconds will have run out of all those fuel sources and then just have your lungs to run with, effectively.
You're just digging in from that point on.
Everyone's dying. If you watch a 400 metre runs, you might think somebody has got a kick. But they have it. Everybody is dying, and somebody is dying at a slightly lesser rate than the rest of them, and that's all that happens. So it's just a test of exhaustion. How exhausted can you be, and can you survive like a couple of seconds longer in that exhaustion?
That's really interesting. So where does mental strength sort of appear in that? Mm. Does it have a bearing on it?
Yes, I mean, so much, because The biggest key differentiator between who will survive that last sort of stretch versus someone else is those that don't push too hard at that point, remain calm, and don't try to, like, almost don't try to race at that point. It's like a meditative
state. So Michael Johnson.
Yeah, yeah.
And Michael Johnson was like the perfect example of that. Was he always looked super relaxed, I thought, anyway.
You could see that he had actually no bearing on what anyone else was doing by that point, you know, and you almost need to be in the race enough to react to the race, but you also, you know, need to pay no attention to the fact you're in a race. And so you have to have this sort of transcendental state to say, like,
good word.
You lost me again. We're not messing around here. So, you know, you have to, like, sort of like, okay, I'm just sort of rolling towards the end of this race, and like, I'm not trying at all. Yeah. And if I see someone to my right or to my left, I'm not paying any attention to that. It's very hard. So, and of course, the way I always used to say to, like, shorter sprinters was, the thing is, you get nervous for your race, but if you have a bad race, all that happens is you end and you go, oh, that was a terrible race. But if I have a bad race, I've got to put up with this pain for like a whole 12 seconds at the end, which is like, and I might not even finish, you know, I might just run out of everything. And a couple of times I fell over, that was it made you very, very anxious before a race, because you're like, if this goes badly, I just know how horrible it's going to be, rather than, if it just goes badly and you finish last, and you go, that was a shame. but actually there's a physical consequence to running badly in the
you've emptied the tank completely.
Completely,
on the recovery side, you're dizzy. You see people trying to stand up and put your hands above your head, stand tall, don't show you're weak. But then when you finish your 400 metres, you see people laying flat on their back.
Yeah, the only thing that gets you that is if you had an amazing win and there's some extra adrenaline. But the best thing that ever I love to see, I think it was the 2015 World Championships and Wade van Niekerk, who's now the world record holder and won in Rio, he finished the race and he couldn't do anything of the celebratory lap. He just couldn't do anything. And he ended up going to hospital because he was just so knackered. And I loved to see that. It made me so happy. I love being the neutral, seeing 400 metre runners absolutely
that reminds
die.
Me. That reminds me of the rowing in the Olympics 2012, and Steve Redgrave was commentating. And I can't remember for the life of me the two guys that were rowing, but I think rowing, again, is one of those sports about emptying the tank, which I don't think you quite get to the same level in rugby. Maybe in training we do, but they got to the end of the race and these guys, they didn't think they'd make a gold, so they were in silver position. No, they might have been in bronze position, so they pushed for a silver really hard, really early, and they got into silver, and then they just had to hang on, and they were hanging on, and they ended up being fourth, I think. And they were devastated. And when they got back to the jetty, Steve Redgrave, they actually couldn't get out of the boat. So Steve actually had to go over, lift one of them out for the interview. And Steve was in tears, crying. And the guy's name, I can't remember.
Which is what you need as well. You need an interview, you know? You need a microphone in front of your face. Perfect timing.
But talk about that. So those boys ended up in fourth as well. So in 2012, your dream, you know, you've hit the standards, you've been building. Sorry, 2008, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So you finished fourth in 2008. You're then building to 2012. Talk us through that training regime as well, so we've got an understanding of what that's like as an Olympian.
Yeah, so I used to train in a fairly unorthodox manner for an elite 400-metre runner at the time. So I'm from Manchester, and I had a really old-school northern coach who would just make us run and run and run, and we'd do loads of volume. So it'd be like, and he smoked 40 fags a day, and be like, yeah, lads, we'll do a bit more mileage today, we'll get a skull down the Mersey, and we'll run along the Mersey for through 5K, and then we'll do this, and then we'll do these hills. And so we used to do that. So we used to do a lot of volume. So we'd do like, we'd run sort of four times a week. Three times of those would be really hard. Those, you know, sessions could be anything like 20 times 150 meters on the track, or just like four flat out 350 meters with sort of 10 minutes in between. And then we'd obviously be in the gym, you know, do my strength and conditioning you guys are familiar with, sort of three or four times a week. We do some plyometrics and all the various auxiliary stuff which goes around being sort of a professional level in sport.
And was that full time, or was that supplemented with another job?
No, I mean, so I think I more or less did it full time from 18. I was planning to go to university. I had a place accepted University of Leeds, and then someone said, hey, we could give you this little bit of money and you could go and race in Italy. And I was like, yeah, cool. So I deferred that and then never went. And then two other times I had a university place that I deferred and then never turned up for over the next 12 years. So it just kind of got in the way. And you know, in some ways, actually, I wish I'd, you know, done both, because I think I very much could have done. But it's funny because at the time everyone goes, no, you can go to university anytime. Yeah. You know, you've got to take advantage of this now. But of course you can't really, because then suddenly you've got, you know, a family coming and a mortgage to pay, and you know, well, I'll just take 4 years out. And, you know, so I do think I could have done both. But no, it's more or less full time. So 6 days a week we train and work towards that. And of course Beijing came along, and it was a really amazing, like, sort of experience. But the funny thing is, looking back at it now, I think as a young sports person, you assume you're going to be successful. That's why you're in it.
Yeah.
And so you don't really pay attention to how great it is to have made the games, or you don't appreciate that. And you go, yeah, okay, well, I've made it. Of course I made it. I'm brilliant. And then you make the semi-final, and you go, okay, of course I made the semi-final. And then you don't make the final, and you're like, oh, I messed up. Like, it's a failure. And then in the relay, we didn't win this medal, and actually, you know, it was like it was devastating, because at the time I think it was the fastest time to ever not win a medal in the 4x400 meter relay.
So did you just on that point? Did you go into that relay expecting to podium, expecting to win? What was the mindset?
If we're being realistic, we probably knew we couldn't win. The US were way away. But we wanted a silver medal.
Okay.
Yeah. So and
who was in the US team at that point?
So Jeremy Warriner, who was the Athens 2004 champion and had run sort of the third fastest time ever. LaShawn Merritt won that games. Two other guys, but they're basically all just rapid.
Yeah.
Just all just like a different level. Man. Like,
the Americans really always seem to be when it comes to athletics.
They've got incredible 400 meter runner depth, you know, and sometimes they don't have the best in the world, but they're always there or thereabouts for sure. And basically we thought, yeah, we can win the silver medal here. You know, we can run with the Bahamas. They were one of the stronger teams. And then we couldn't really pick a third place that was like, a given.
Yep.
And certainly the Russian didn't factor into our calculations at all. But then interestingly, they didn't run their fastest runner in the individual event, which is very odd. So and this guy came out of nowhere and ran like a 42 point something split or a 40 low 43 something split. And basically just like pushed us into fourth.
And what was the gap between third and
like,
fourth?
I think it was like 0.3 of a second or something.
Wow,
like that. Yeah,
so
yeah, it's a small margin. But track is always small margin. Yeah. So it doesn't. That's not, you know, if it was hundredth of a second, yeah, that would be a really small margin.
Especially if you're not expecting them to be thereabouts.
It was just funny because you know, we all ran really well and we ran really fast. Like I said, fastest.
Who's
time
your team?
Ever.
Who was your team?
It was myself, Martin Rooney would be the name most people know, and then two other guys, Michael Bingham and Robert Tobin. And we did amazingly, but we just finished fourth, and you just sort of were like, oh right, well that was pointless.
And, how does that feel? Is that a little bit like, I can imagine finishing fourth from trying to put it into my own mindset would be a little bit like drawing a match, you know?
Yeah.
Where you get to the end and you feel like there's nothing. Necessarily,
it's hard to get a like for like, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess the best way I was had it put to me was shortly after that games, I was giving a speech at a local primary school, as you do.
Did you have your tracksuit on, like David Thompson?
Of course. Yeah. I tried to avoid this, but basically, I was in. Do you remember in Little Britain they used to have a sketch? Where
you were that person. Yeah, I love that sketch.
Love it. The lucrative world of primary school speaking, as you know, it goes a long way.
Did you do a slightly better job than David Walliams did when he was in his?
I don't think so. But I got interrupted by a little girl. I know she must have been five or six, and she said, my daddy told me that when you finish fourth, you get a handshake. And I was like, so you obviously got the phrase like that she'd heard. Like, all you get for fourth is a handshake. But she thought that was amazing that you got like a special handshake.
Yeah.
And I was like, no one even shook my hand, to be fair. So I didn't even get back. But it's just it's just very deflating because you're very close. You've done really well. You're fourth in the world.
Yeah.
In most other tournaments, that would be, it's still pretty good. Like, it's like, oh, wow, World Cup semi-finalist or whatever.
Just on that, this fascinates me when I speak to Olympians, because people who are Olympians, Paralympians, when they look at their career goals, so as a rugby player, my dream was to play for England.
Mm.
What I found with athletes, their dream is to win an Olympic medal. They don't say win an Olympic gold medal, they say, my dream is to win a medal.
Yeah.
And is that the same as you or your team?
Yeah, which is the only time you get a tangible reward.
Is there a difference between winning a medal or winning a gold medal?
There is, and I just think the goalposts just move as you progress. So I think when I was young, if I would have said, hey, you'll be able to run for Great Britain once, I would have thought, that's cool. But then the moment you get it, you're like, well, it's not enough.
What's next?
Yeah. So it just always moves, you know. If you think, oh, it's a play for England, but then if you've got a number of caps and then you're like, well, the World Cup's coming around, he's getting that squad and so on, right? You know, so it just, the goalposts just always move. And I think you say an Olympic medal, most people would of course be like, you know, I want to go for that gold, but it's about just, if I get a medal, then everyone acknowledges, yeah, you were good. You know, like that's the one thing which like people know.
Even though you've like Europeans and world championships,
you can win the world championships.
Yeah, but still not.
If you don't even qualify, let's say you didn't even qualify for the games because you were injured or something, but you won the worlds. Most people in everyday life wouldn't know you were any good. They only, have you been to the Olympics? Yes, but you could be the world record holder. And you didn't make the Olympic Games, and they wouldn't respect it the same way. So it just holds a special cachet for the everyday public, I guess.
I find it fascinating, your story, and certainly your relay story. So you finished fourth in Beijing. So in your mind, you're not thinking that's the only Olympic Games you're going to. So you're thinking, right, we finished fourth, next Olympics, lads, we're going one step further.
So all you ever think about is like, oh yeah, well, of course I was good, I should be winning, so I'm going to win next time. And that's all you did. And of course, I had 4 years running up to London 2012, the Home Olympic Games, the biggest possible occasion you could ever have hoped for. And I can't sort of exaggerate that enough, that from 2005 when we awarded the games, you didn't meet, or a day didn't go by where someone was like, are you going to be at London 2012? Are you going to be at London 2012? You don't know till 3 weeks before, but you get every waking breath was completely defined.
3 weeks before? I didn't know that. Yeah. So the team's actually only finalised. That's what it makes sense, like a World Cup squad picked, you know, weeks before.
I guess the difference in track and field is that you don't really get named to a squad. So it's competition by competition, I guess. So, you know, you couldn't say, I'm on the GB squad as a rule. Yeah. It's every single competition different. So, 3 weeks before, you don't know. You know you've got a chance, but you have to win the trials or come second in the Olympic trials. And then if you're in just for the relay, hope you're in the top six and they'll take that exact top six and so on. So you never can plan. But it was such a big occasion. And of course, running up to that, I was like, well, I'm not happy with being a semi-finalist in the individual event. I'd like to win a medal in the individual event, and I'll need about half a second off my time in order to do that. So I need literally like that much time off my personal best. From 44.9 to about 44.4 would put me in with a chance of an individual medal in the games. So it's so small. And so 4 years, I've just got to get a finger click quicker over those 4 years. And so one of the things that happened was, in the performance review, which happens after a major champs, like it does in a lot of professional sports, we had sort of the performance director, my coach, various other people that had a say in my, stakeholders in my journey, I guess. And we said, well, how are you going to get faster from now to then? And they said, well, most people at the top level, they don't train like you. They train like elite 200 meter runners who do some endurance on top. That's far more common at the top level. And plus, you're pretty awful out of the blocks. Like, I'm terrible. I'm a terrible starter, but I could hold on to my top speed a bit longer than most. So getting up to speed took me a long time. And they said, if you can sort that first 50 out and train like everyone else, you'll probably get half a second off your time.
Yeah, there's
like,
your finger click. You start, there's your finger click.
Yeah, so it's amazing. Right? And I was like, yes, I agree. Like, that would be great. It also had lots of nice side effects, like more time in sort of warm weather training and more, less of this sort of running along the River Mersey graft and so on. And so we went for it. And the short version of it is it didn't work. Over the next 4 years, my career stuttered, went downhill more or less. I got about a second slower on average instead of that half second quicker. And actually on the last race I did, which was the day before selection for London 2012, I ran exactly one second slower than the time I ran in Beijing 2008. And I was number 7 in the country as opposed to number 1 in the country, which I was then. And they take the top 6. So I literally missed out on the team by one place. But it was a big fall, like actually from where I was to where I was. And I couldn't comprehend it. I was like, it was like a death in the family. It was so huge.
That's your moment. That's the thing you've been gearing up
for. I was like, I'm not even going to be there. It's like, I could not get my head around it. And I actually, my family used to have this caravan in the Lake District. I just went there on my own. And like, I didn't speak to anyone for 2 weeks. So I had to shut myself off from it. I couldn't, I was just like, I can't really interact with people. I can't describe this. I can't bear like telling people I'm not even there. And now
people wouldn't understand either.
Yeah, they wouldn't understand what it meant to me because they're like, oh, poor you. You didn't compete at the home Olympic Games like nobody gets to do.
Yeah.
You know, plus, yeah, you've been running one Olympics and you're running at the next. It was just like, and also to put into perspective, the year before that, because my performances had been dropping, I'd been dropped from funding. I had 20 grand on credit card debt that I'd used to try and pursue.
The year before?
Yeah.
So that's what I was going to come on to now. So the people who are listening won't be aware of your... It's not just a case of, do you know what, in 4 years I've got 1 second slower or I've missed out of form. There were lots of little bits.
It has a lot of impact,
going on. And I've done my research on you as well with the Epstein-Barr virus. Yeah. And you've touched on the loss of funding. So mentally, there are lots of hurdles to... If you're comparing yourself with the dips that you've had to somebody who hasn't had those dips, you're in a worse
spot. So it's like a vicious cycle, because if you run a little bit slower, you lose some cash, so the pressure to run faster, and you don't make much cash in athletics, like literally, it's like just enough to get by, right? And I think my funding was £800 a month, right? So we're not like, we're not rolling in it, guys.
Wow.
And so the impact it had is so huge. And then, of course, it probably makes you more likely to get injury because you can't afford to have the treatment that you would have all the time, and so on. So it's a really hard spiral to get out of once you start performing worse. And it's compounded by the fact you then maybe get dropped off the nationalised sort of funding programme, which is fair enough. You're running slower, you shouldn't necessarily be funded. And so I was like 1 year out from the games, I was like, well, I can't just like not try. I have to just put everything on this. And so the stakes become that much higher. And I remember I had a sponsorship deal with with a logistics company that I'd gone around and peddled myself at all these like business networking lunches, saying, "Hey guys, this is me. I'm looking for this." It was quite an interesting concept, but and I found this deal, and this deal gave me 50% of the cash to fund sort of half the year, and then I
to
got
fund
the,
your training. So you're an Olympian.
Yeah,
you're trying to get to the next Olympic Games, home Olympic Games, and you've got to go out externally to try and get enough funding. Not to live a better life, but just to enable you to train to get to the Olympic Games.
Just literally to pay the rent.
And that's the same as for all athletes. Everyone's in the same boat.
Exactly, You know, so look, if you're running well, there's great support from the nationalised UK sport funding. But that by default, that has to have a high bar. You know, like so you can only get that if you're passing a certain number of protocol and criteria. And I wasn't at the time, which is fair enough. So I was just trying to like get, you know, give me 10 grand for the year. I'll get by on that. But basically I had half that was due once I got selected for the squad. And I was like, kind of, all I need is that to like pay off some of the credit card debt and all this stuff. And basically it didn't
work. That's 7 to 6, the difference between 7th and 6th and 7th.
That's all that mattered, yeah. So that had a real tangible financial difference for me.
That's massive, yeah.
So before we carry on with the interview, I'm excited to say we've had a little present dropped into the podcast today. Leon's got it in his hands. He's just unpackaging it from Harry's, the online shaving brand. You've got it out of its box. And as a man with a very shiny head, I imagine you've used one of these before.
Three choice. First and foremost, I've got this travel blade cover, and I've just made the error of squirting the rich shave gel
where
onto my hand.
Good.
And I don't know how it's going to come off, but it smells lovely.
At least you've got it on your hand in the studio, though, because that's practical, isn't it? Around all this electrical
equipment. It does smell lovely.
Yeah, so what else?
And we've got a weighted ergonomic handle on this on this bad boy.
That looks ergonomic as well. What else have we got in there?
So we've got five precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade.
Oh, lubricating strips, hey? Mrs. Lloyd Fonda.
What do you mean by that?
You'll be using that later.
What do you mean by that? That is just so immature.
Well, it's just commenting, it's got a lubricating strip, and that's very important. A smooth finish.
It's a good bit of kit.
Yeah, you've got it on your hands as well. You're actually going to go on.
I'm going to have to try it out now because it's on, mate.
Whilst you do that, I just need to let everyone know. So this exclusive offer is for you guys, and if you want to get hold of a trial set from Harry's, you can get a special offer at £3.95 by really simply going to harrys.com/whistle to get yours. That's harrys.com/whistle.
How smooth is that? Can you see?
It's very shiny.
But anyway, I didn't make the team and it had a lot of consequences. I was left suddenly, I looked at my life and I was like, I've got no CV because I didn't have any work experience other than being an athlete, really.
Obviously,
the Botswana and hip hop career was burgeoning.
It was ready to go.
I was absolutely rolling in royalties for the Botswana charts. Topper, but which I wasn't, and I had no education because I'd turned down university, and I had loads of credit card debt, and I was like, oh my god, like I've really messed up my life here. Like
How old are you at this point?
27. Yeah, so it wasn't like I'm not that young either. You know, like it was like okay, and you know, most people have had 4 to 5 years experience in a job, been working their way up, whatever. And I was like, how can I even get a job here? I can't go on a graduate scheme. I can't afford to do an internship. I was just like, I don't know what to do. Like, it was really odd. And so the consequences of that, you know, running that bit slower and that slight change in the training were really impactful. So I managed to, and here's an interesting story, how I found one more year of support, and I got that by my best friend is Greg Rutherford, the Olympic long jump champion from London 2012. And in April 2012, on our warm weather training camp, we had a pact that we put together. And he said, if I win the Olympics, you're not allowed to retire from the sport. And I was like, well, that's fine, but someone's going to have to pay. And he's like, well, if I win Olympics, I'll pay for your year's training.
Oh, wow.
And he did. And wow. So we travelled the world that year. Like,
how did that?
I've got a friend who I played with rugby with who's not sat too far away from us, who never made me cease to
I actually got your first job when you retired at my old school, Oakham School, by the way, brilliant place.
Greg. So Greg actually helped you. It was an important part of your...
It's a very important part of me sort of carrying on. And so we were off to train in Arizona and all over. We circumnavigated the globe that year. We competed in Australia and then went to the US and so on. And Greg paid for me to come along. And that gave me an opportunity. And during that time, I got sent a swab in the post by a guy who was starting a business and was interested in finding feedback from sports people on the role genetics might play in response to training and exercise. And I did this thing. I was like, yeah, whatever, cool. Let's have a look at it. I'm searching for a lot of answers about why the normal training didn't work for me, etc. And actually, the results I got back were sort of spoke quite personally to my experience of what worked and what didn't. It's really only one part of the story, but I think I've just the way I was built to train and to respond to 400 meter training for my goal was a little bit anomalous compared to everyone else. So therefore, the way I should have trained should have also been anomalous, and I didn't know that stuff. I only found out through trial and error that the old school way worked for me. The new school way was less effective, but it was kind of too late by that point. And I took that into account, and I just emailed the guy who's actually our CEO and founder, saying, by the way, this is my experience. This is what you've told me. And there was a few other factors that really matched: increased raised risk of Achilles tendon injury. I'd had sort of relentless Achilles tendon problems throughout my career, etc. And I said, well done. you've got a really cool thing here. Let me know if I can help with any intros in sport or whatever. And we met when I got back from America, and we got on very well, and I became sort of employee number one there at this company, DNA Fit.
And DNA Fit is about wellness, so it's a global company now. Mm-hmm. So just talking on that wellness point of view, now you've obviously had a successful transition. There must have been a window when that 2012... Olympic Games slipped by. Well, what did the dark moments look like for you post, you spoke about living in a caravan for a little bit on your own. Were there any other dark moments? I want to understand where you got to, because so many of our mates, in rugby, dealing with depression, dealing with, bankruptcy, all sorts of things. As an Olympian, what happened post 2012? You was a 27-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, I was entirely depressed and felt like I'd ruined my life by pursuing sport in any way, And I thought, like, I've reached the Olympic Games, but for what? Like, I've absolutely ruined everything. I was really, really depressed. And, it was an extremely dark place. I couldn't speak to anyone. I couldn't go out. Like, I couldn't function in any way.
Where were you living?
So I was, at the time, I was living in a rented room in a house with friends in Manchester, but I just vanished. Like, no one heard from me. I didn't sort of see my family for ages. And, eventually, a couple of weeks later, saw my girlfriend eventually and sort of came slightly back into society. But it took me many, many months to even think about, how to function in everyday life. And this is a challenge, right? This goes on so much.
Yeah, I'm going to say, you'll be aware of there'll be lots of people who your friends, your peers, who have gone through similar things, who have missed out.
Yeah.
So whilst we're hearing this, it might be a shock to people listening, but this happens regularly to people all the time.
This is the norm.
Yeah, right?
This isn't the anomaly.
This has happened to...
Because most people don't make the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
A lot of people think they've got a chance. And most people don't have any funding support or, that sort of professional sort of support around them. By that point, I didn't. So when I didn't make it, there was no one there to say, okay, here's the exit path, this is what we do, this is the support available. I was already out of that infrastructure. And so you just fall off a cliff of having any relevance to anyone. You don't hear from anyone that you heard from all your life while you were running well or you were competing. It just goes, everything about everything you know about your identity, the support structure, the infrastructure around who you are as a sports person, it's just completely in thin air.
Do you remember a moment of rock bottom and what rock bottom looked like for you or not?
Yeah, I mean, I was in this caravan in the pouring rain in the Lake District in Cumbria, and I hadn't even really left this caravan, and I didn't have any Wi-Fi there or anything, and I just thought, I don't know what I'm going to do in my life here. I might try and I'll see if anyone I know has got a job for me, and I'll just move on from it. But I couldn't even think of that as a thing. So I've no hesitation in saying I was really sort of clinically depressed at that point, and felt really, really unhopeful about the future, but also about who I was, because I think the biggest thing people forget with sport is that from a very young age, your entire identity is defined by the fact that you've chosen this career.
Yeah.
And everyone supports it and loves the fact you've done it. And they go, you're a rugby player, and you're a runner. And no matter what you do in life, everyone identifies you as that. And in any other career, that doesn't happen. Like you, you're an insurance salesman. Yay, insurance salesman, what are you doing? You know, oh, not a friend, he's an insurance salesman. Like, you know, whereas everyone else, when you're a sports person, oh, one of my friends is a rugby player, originally. Yeah. One of my friends is an Olympian. So everything about who you are is defined by your career choice. And you've not known, normally, you've not known many friendship groups that aren't other sports people. You've not known any professional relationships that aren't other sports people. And you certainly haven't got anything else about you, generally speaking. Yeah. And thankfully, I was lucky enough that I'd kind of kept the music stuff up and I had a little bit of something about my personal identity in my head that was a bit different, but often you don't. So it was very hard to figure out who I was. And I think that's the challenge, not what you do with the career, but who are you?
How did you figure it out? Or did you?
I think I only figured it out by just being open to experience. And and that's where, you know, the interesting thing for me is now I look back on it, I won this Olympic medal retrospectively.
I was going to, yeah, just before you go on there, I was going to say to you, how are you feeling in that caravan?
Yeah.
Go back to 2008. If you'd have finished third or second or anything else, do you think you'd have still felt as low in that caravan for not making the 2012 games? Or do you think it was a point of, do you know what? The dream that my moment didn't get it in 2008 because you hadn't been given your medal by then.
Yeah.
Not going to get it in 2012. Is that, do you think that added to the
so
build-up?
I would have felt low, but I also personally think if I'd won that medal, I probably would have made the London 2012 Games. So,
but you said, okay, that good. I'm glad you answered that because it leads on to my next question. Yeah. We've talked about this before, and you've said before, finishing fourth, originally finishing fourth, where you didn't think you'd finish on the podium, was one of the best things that happened to you.
It was, yeah. Only now can I say that, but at the time I didn't think so. So if I'd won the medal at the time, I would have been guaranteed funding for the next Olympiad, so the whole 4 years. That funding would have been more than I'd ever had, so I would have been more comfortable. And success breeds success, right? So I potentially probably would have got faster, and I probably would have had more of the personal position to push back on the training change,
So,
guys, it's working. I've got an Olympic medal, plus I've run 44 seconds, rather than, I'll take any advice on how to get better. So, you know, the chances are it would have kept me on a slightly different path, and that path would probably be more successful. But the realistic outcome for me would have been, the best I could have hoped for would probably have been the final at London Olympics.
As an individual?
As an individual, sorry. Maybe another relay medal, though the guys also finished fourth in 2012, so not given.
Not given yet.
Yeah, maybe. And possibly at the very best ever, I think I maybe could have won the individual gold at a European Champs in the absolute perfect scenario. But for what? Like, it still doesn't really get you anywhere.
So your life would... Yeah. Do you not think... Would you feel more fulfillment? Do you tick that box of achieve those things or not?
I think you would, but you also become very narrow in who you are, because the more successful you are, the more you, by default, defined by that, and the less open to other things, other experience you become in life.
Would you describe... So you've actually, you've had great success now. Can you define yourself differently now that you have got through those dark days and, you know, were you seeking your sort of gold medal moment in a different way? And is that how you've ended up where you are now with DNA?
I can only think so, is that I think being a sports person gives you a lot of quality in doing other things, because you've known the only thing that matters to you is the quality of your work. All your life as a sports person, the quality of your day job defines how successful you are as an individual. Everything about your personality is defined by your success in your job. And so the difference once you enter the world of, you know, the workplace, as it were, whether that's as an entrepreneur or just in a role in a corporate, is that your quality of your output at work will define to you who you are, and it will define your personal satisfaction with yourself, actually. And sports people are like that. We've hired a number of sports people in the company over the years, and they truly care about that they do the very best work possible. And they'll still, you know, they'll still always be like normal people, and they still have to go to work and still have, you know, sort of tiredness about having to turn up at work, etc. But the emotional investment in the quality of their work is that which you see from sports people in their training. And so I think there's a really positive thing being a sports person entering the world of work, but you're too often, you've sacrificed so much that you can't get in that conversation. You can't even let yourself into thinking about, I might just get a job somewhere, because that's like a it's like a downgrade in your mind almost, isn't it? That you weren't just famous from your sports and you could just trade off that for the rest of your life. And also you can't actually tick a box that lets you into like graduate programs or into sort of the normal sort of work environment, because you might not have the education, you might not have the experience, you might not know how to write a CV. So it's a very hard mix of trying to take advantage of the fact that someone was a sports person as an individual, but also making sure that you've got enough of the sort of the backup, as it were, to let you move on to something else after sport. And by default, sports people don't want to plan for the future, because that's a plan B. That's almost admitting defeat. Yeah. You know, we all think we will be the very best there ever was. That's why you do it, and that's why you're good. But actually, there needs to be some happy medium between those two. And for me, that happy medium was, actually, thank God I didn't win that Olympic medal at the time. I'm really glad now I've got it retrospectively. Yeah. But I feel like it's the best of both worlds for me, because it made me open to experience. I was open to email this guy and say, by the way, this is a good product. Maybe I can help.
You mentioned plan B, which is absolutely critical part of what we do. As you know, I work at Switch to Play. We talk about the stuff you develop outside as being not plan B.
Exactly.
Not thinking,
that's how it has to be framed.
I'm going to go and do this and develop my CV. I'm going to develop my work experience because if I don't make it as an athlete, I've got that to fall back on. However, what you've demonstrated on this when we've been chatting is that should be an extension of your plan A.
Yeah.
I want to go and do these things because it actually helped me become an athlete, helped me better prepare with perspective and everything else, so that when that time comes, I can transition smoother. So if you were to give advice to a younger version of yourself, before you even get to Beijing, and that first university offer comes in. Yep. Do you think what would you say to your younger version?
So I think the way you have to frame it is that actually anything you do that might prepare you better for life after sport will help you perform better in the sport itself. In the corporate world, they quite well understand now that you need a work-life balance. To do the best work, you have to also have something else outside of work for you to be able to focus when you are at work. And the same in sport life. You know, the sport life balance has not really been talked about as a thing.
It's coming now. We're pushing it now.
And so you guys are doing amazing work on that. And actually what you need is you need something else outside of the hours when you're training, so you can still free your mind from the pressure of trying to achieve the highest goal in your sport. And it will only help you reach that. It's this sort of sport life balance, this sort of life and performance balance that I think will only help performance. And the problem for me is, I don't think you can rely on sports people themselves to engineer this. And I don't think you can make it an option, because too many of us will think this is a plan B because they don't think I'm going to be good enough. So it almost has to be reframed and almost like mandatory, compulsory. If you're a federation that wants someone to run for you, compete for you, so you can sell broadcast rights, so you can earn off the fact that as a rugby team, you also have a duty to make sure that any of those players that are playing for you and helping you earn that cash are given the setup and the infrastructure to be rounded human beings that can enter the wider world once you no longer need them and you dispose of them as a federation or a team. And I think that's really important, that sports people see this as something that will help them perform, plus make them really useful people and give them a purpose after sport.
Any desire to get back into your sport to help influence what you've just said there? Because I think what you just said is spot on.
Yeah.
What it needs. Have you got any desire to... Are you still involved in the sport? Could you see yourself coming back in at a senior level to help influence that?
Yeah, I'd absolutely love to. So, like, you know, I've been, as you may know, over the last few years, you know, I've also been sort of working with Greg and still involved in the sport that way, which has been great, almost from the agent side. But also, you know, been talking to a lot of people, and yourself included, about how do we elicit sort of policy change here, because there is this duty of care and there's a big failing, even from the wider public understanding of the challenges sports people face when they retire from sport. And we just need to frame success as a great thing in sport, but they also need success as rounded human beings around that. So I'd love to be able to influence some sort of policy change, some sort of infrastructure which gives sports people that... just foundation as human beings, not just as, hey, a niche physical task performer. And that's all that currently is lauded and celebrated. And you need to celebrate the fact that gives them opportunities to do a lot more stuff.
Andy, it's a great note to finish on. It's been a pleasure chatting to you today. It really has been a pleasure, and listening to your story and, you know, the struggles, but the successes that you've that you've been able to push on to in life and retirement. So as always, thanks for listening. If you haven't, then please go on to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you subscribe to your podcast, rate, review, subscribe to this one. Give us your feedback. We really want to hear your thoughts and views. And also, if you want any other guests, if you want to hear from anyone in particular, then do let us know. Contact us on social media. Me at LewisMoody7. Leon's at something 13, obviously, because we love our we love throwing back. Would you have had a number in athletics? Yeah, would
no,
you have had,
just no. My name. So you don't have, that's my social media handle.
Is it ridiculous? Like football, rugby, you've got to have your number.
It's about identity. We've got to step out of that identity.
You've got to open your mind. Well, you are. You just told that whole conversation is still.
I'm changing mine.
By our
I'm changing. Right. I'm changing it now.
Instantly on social media after this. Anyway, no. What is yours? Go on.
Leon Lloyd 13. Well, it's going to be changed, but it's Leon Lloyd 13.
The minute. Not nearly just.
Athletes put their event on their name. That's how they do it. So yeah. I'd be Andrew Steele 400 or whatever.
Lewis Moody World Cup winner. He's got that.
That's the other one.
It's embarrassing.
Anyway, so please send your thoughts in, contact us on social media, and subscribe to the podcast, and let's hear your thoughts. After the Whistle is produced in association with the fantastic Audio Boom. Thank you for listening, and we'll speak again soon.